Bethany.
And I'm Joel.
And this is Sunday School Cinema. Hooray! On time! All the things!
Part two of our Ingmar Bergman special series here that we're accidentally doing.
Literally, when we were rolling for the, or when you were looking for the number, I was like, I just was like, we don't have that many left. It feels entirely possible we could end up with the other Ingmar Bergman. And here we are. Here we are.
So, this is The Seventh Seal, which is, I think, safe to say, his best-known movie, at least in the U.S., I guess. I don't know about elsewhere, but this is the one that I think kind of got him brought over to U.S. audiences. From 1957, so that's like 6 years before Winterlight, the one we watched last time. A lot of the same cast as we talked about last time. He was the guy who liked to do that. Max von Sydow is the lead. We've got Gunnar Bjornstrand, who is the pastor in Winterlight, is in this one as well in a supporting role. Bibi Anderson, who he worked with a ton. She was in like, I don't know, 15 of his movies maybe. so yeah, a lot of his regulars. And then this one is a return to the period piece like The Virgin Spring was. I'm not sure exactly relative to each other where they are supposed to be set time-wise. They both have kind of a medieval setting. This one, I guess, is like 14th century, I think, because it's set during the Black Death. But it has a lot more. It's a more complicated movie than Winterlight, which is a very sort of bare bones kind of affair.
Yeah, I think this was not the first Bergman movie I saw. The first one was Sawdust and Tinsel, which I disliked so much.
Yeah, that's a weird choice. I feel like we've talked about that before, but very strange way to begin.
I didn't make a choice. Jared rented things, and then
I mean, that was how I watched all the stuff that I watched too. But I think Seventh Seal was probably the first one I saw. I don't remember for sure, but I think it probably was.
Yeah, no. But I did really like The Seventh Seal, and I still really like The Seventh Seal. I'm not sure if I like it quite as much as you. I feel like this time I moved it to a 4, but I also feel like depending on when I watched again, it could be a 4.5. Like, it's definitely a movie that I'm never like, I'm furious that I need to rewatch this film. So, you know.
Yeah, it's been a solid 5 out of 5 for me for a long time. I think it's this is hardly a opinion that's unique to me, but I think it's a masterpiece. I think it's probably still my favorite of his. I've seen a bunch of his movies. I don't think any of the others. I love several of them, but I don't think any of the others approach this one for me.
Yeah, and I think so. I mean, essentially, it's this knight coming back from the Crusades, and death wanders up to him looking very dramatic in his fancy black cloak and stuff. And
yeah, there's an actor named Bengt Ekeroth. I'm sure I'm saying that name wrong, but he plays death and is kind of it's like a famous image. Like, you'd probably recognize it even if you don't know the movie. And it's been very like, this movie has a lot of sort of iconography in it that is recognizable from other movies. If you've watched a lot of movies, and the appearance of death is definitely a prime example.
Yeah, there's definitely been a lot. I think you mentioned last time that like the playing chess thing was in Bill and Ted. I feel like the death appearing thing has also been like, you know, joked about in a lot of different movies and shows. and death is like, hey, it's your time. And he was like, but like, and death is like, okay, people always say this. And he's like, why don't you play a game of chess with me? And I get as long as it takes to play the game. And I get to get away if I win. And so then the game of chess sort of goes on throughout.
Yeah, they'll play a few moves at a time, and then he'll continue, because he's on his journey home from having been fighting a crusade for 10 years, he said, which is one of those weird things. Like, when people went to war back then, it was like, obviously going to the other side of the world was a much bigger deal back then than it is now, and they would just go for years. He left his beloved wife behind to go fight this stupid fool's errand for 10 years. did you know, how old would you guess Max von Sydow was in this movie?
Late 30s, maybe?
He was 27 when they filmed this movie. And he does definitely look older, but it was interesting to, for me to realize that, because I suspect that's probably about the age that the character is supposed to be. Because I'm sure he would have been very young when he left, and they, like, when he does get home and his wife sees him, she refers to him as the boy that went, that, you know, that went away or whatever. Like, I suspect he was supposed to be very young when he left, and like his whole adult life has been fighting this crusade, and he finally gets home and is immediately confronted by death. Like, what a life, right? So he is going through a lot of the same sort of personal torments that the pastor in Winter Light was. He believes in God because he doesn't want to believe in God, but he feels like he can't get God out of his soul, even though he can't find any, like, he's sick of faith and having to believe on trust. He wants something concrete and he can't find it anywhere, but he feels like he can't get God out of his system, basically.
It's hard to imagine why this would have appealed to us so much.
I know, right? This movie is basically like, it is him traveling. It starts with him on the shore, so presumably like immediately after he gets home, because he probably would have sailed home. And it follows him on his travels to try to return to his wife. And he sort of, him and his squire at the beginning, that's Gunnar Bjornstrand, who is could not be a more different character in this than he was in Winter Light. He's almost like one of the not quite comic relief. I don't think that's quite the right term for it, but he literally does like comedy bits.
He's super funny.
He is very, he's very funny. So it's the two of them traveling through Sweden to return home. And they're kind of meeting people and picking up people along the way, but they are in the middle of the Black Death, which is, it is funny to think, you know, we think about, like, we've had this ongoing plague in America and in around the world, we talk about it in those terms, but the Black Death wiped out half the population of Europe. Like, it's like literal horror movie shit. Like, almost everyone who got it died, and half the people in the world got it, or in that part of the world. I mean, it wasn't even just Europe. I think it was also North Africa and the Middle East. So it's really, I mean, they're traveling along and there's just like rotting corpses sitting by the side of the road. Like, it is horror movie shit. And so, of course, they have this literal and figurative sort of specter of death following them, and seeing all kinds, they encounter people. There's a woman who's going to be burned as a witch because people believe that she was the one who started the plague, which, I mean, absurd on the face of it, because it's been going for years and is widespread, but they think this like teenage girl was the one who caused it, so they're gonna burn her at the stake.
I was gonna say, less a woman, more a child.
And they refer to her that way too, actually. I think she's supposed to be a teenager. And but our hero, Antonius Block is his name, which is a great name, is so like desperate for some concrete sign of the supernatural that when he is told by her guards that she had encounters with the devil, that he goes to her to ask her, like, what's the devil like? How did you find him? Because I need to ask him about God, because he would know if anyone would know. And what he finds out is that, I was unclear on if she was actually supposed to be a witch or if it was just kind of like the results of her being tormented or whatever. But essentially, whatever belief she might have in the devil is just as much faith as all of the people have in God. Like, he's trying to get like, did he say that to you? And she's like, no, I know it.
Like, well, actually, and I think it's interesting because it's not just like my impression watching it is that at this point she's probably gone a little crazy. She's, you know, been being tortured for however long. I'm sorry to my dog who I just kicked in the face. But also that, like, when he says that he doesn't see anything but terror in her eyes or whatever, like she's like, but like everyone saw, like the guards saw, like it's almost, it's not even like, I did not get the impression that she had like sought this out in any meaningful way, but like every single person she encountered were like, we can see the devil on you. And she was like, and like, I don't know, your brain tries to make sense of it.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And especially because it was, you know, that like the people who were holding her were like, they were so afraid of her that they wouldn't touch her because they saw the devil in her, like that, you know, and yet they were still planning on burning her alive. Like, yeah, I mean, obviously that would fuck with your head pretty severely, but it's interesting that he's, Block is so desperate for some concrete evidence of God and the supernatural that he's even like specifically seeking out the devil. Like, how do I talk to this guy?
Yeah, and I think that, like, you know, I mean, the only thing in this bleak world that we know exists is death, right? Like, I mean, yes, we see it as a physical specter, but like also like there is no one knows, and no one knows what happens past death, and no one knows. We've got this acrobat performer dude who like sees visions, but like not entirely, like I don't think he ever talks to Block about his visions really, and even if he did, it's still,
no, I think he only talks to his wife about it.
Yeah, and even if he did, I don't know that Block would consider that to be like proof evidence, and so like, you know, they it's just like this, there's a lot of hopelessness, and yet it is a significantly less bleak movie than Winter Light in that there's also a lot of humor and a lot of funny things and a lot of just wild, a lot from Gunnar, whatever, his squire.
Jons, I believe, is the character's name, yeah.
Yes, Jons. But it's like, this is all we can really do, right? Like, that's his response to the emptiness of life is like, we're going to make fun of it. Cause like,
what? Right. His whole demeanor is like black humor. Like, he doesn't really have any faith anymore. And he's, you know, kind of looks down on all the people around him who are still dumb enough to believe, basically. And, you know, I think about, this is the thing that I think about all the time. Like, whether or not there was, like, who was the first, like, true atheist, you know? Like, because most people in these times literally wouldn't have, like, a mental framework to conceive of the concept of God not existing. And I wonder about a lot, like, how many people were genuinely atheists in this period of time. Like, if that existed as a belief structure, or if that didn't really come around until later, but it's because he's basically that, like, you know, whatever God there is, he is clearly indifferent and he's just not interested.
I was going to say, I think that a lot of times it probably came more to that of like, okay, like God, maybe gods exist, but who fucking cares? Like, even if they do, it doesn't benefit us in any way. And if anything, it might do the opposite. Like, and I suspect, because to me, I would consider that to be like, obviously that's not atheist in the strictest definition of the word, but within that frame of like, okay, maybe gods exist, but it doesn't matter. Like, I think that's pretty close in terms of...
So yeah, we have these traveling performer characters, which are B.B. Anderson, who I mentioned, and the guy Joff is his name, or Joff, is played by a guy is Niels Poppe, P-O-P-P-E, I don't know how you say that, who apparently was like, this is the only Bergman movie he was ever in, which, but apparently, like, I was looking at his filmography, he had a ton of stuff, and it looks like he was almost like a Charlie Chaplin-esque sort of comic actor in Sweden. He has like dozens of movies that he starred in, and he wrote and directed a bunch of them and stuff. And he's very much like a clown sort of character in this. Although one thing that I thought was very funny, I assume unintentionally funny, was that they talked several times about what a skilled juggler he was, but we see him pick up balls to juggle on screen several times. And he can't juggle more than two at a time, which isn't even actually juggling. But he never, like, it happens three or four times, and he never has more than two. It was a weird choice. I don't really understand if that was an intentional joke that I don't really get, or if they, I don't know, it was weird.
I think I did assume it was an intentional joke just because it did happen multiple times. It felt like that was part of the joke of, like, that he was not actually that good of a
joke. Right, that these guys are, they're kind of a joke as a as performers, I guess. I don't know. I mean, their whole, you know, we see a big chunk of one of their shows, and it's, you know, mostly like, I guess it's what you picture when you think of like medieval traveling entertainer troupes, you know, the jester costume and the devil costume and, you know, drums and flutes and goofy songs, basically. But it is all, I have no idea how like historically accurate it all was or anything, but it's all pretty entertaining to watch.
So yeah, I mean, I don't know. They're wandering across this other trio. Initially, it's the husband and wife and this other guy, and they also have a baby. And I spent a lot of time, although I did not actually go down the rabbit hole for this. Maybe I will at some point. Wondering what people did before diapers. Did children just pee everywhere? I don't know.
He just wandered around without pants on. So I assume that he just had like a tunic kind of thing on. With, you know, Winnie the Pooh style, nothing from the waist down. So I kind of assumed that that was how they did it, but I don't know. Yeah, it's not what the movie's interested in, I guess.
Just that little butt, just hanging out everywhere. Anyway, I don't know. They do a show in some town, and this and the head of their troop or whatever gets something thrown at him and gets pissed off and like runs off stage to clean himself up. And while he's there, this young blonde woman very sensually offers him a picnic lunch.
Yeah. That whole bit is like, it's like some weirdly broad comedy. Cause we have it's like archetypal characters. It's like this dim-witted blacksmith and his way too hot wife, who is like seducing every man that comes through town, and like he's too dim-witted to figure out what's happening, and then he eventually figures it out and gets all mad and drunk, and like it's all like almost like vaudevillian style comedy. And we have there's whole bits of like the Jan's character and the blacksmith character doing like comic like a two-man comedy bit. Where they're doing like a back and forth dialogue about, you know, how women are ruining their lives, and it's all like it's very funny and weird. It is not the sort of patter that you expect to get in a movie like this, but it's all, I don't know, it's all pretty funny. It's all really well played.
Yeah, no, it is funny, and it is, and it allows for, again, something of a break in the because the, like Joel said, I mean, the world that they're traveling through is a fucking horror show. Like.
Well, right. We kind of get this back and forth because during this sequence of the performance of their play, they get interrupted by this parade of, I don't know what you'd call them, but there are these parades of people that are just wandering through the country, carrying crosses and burning incense and beating themselves with whips and preaching about doomsday and begging God for mercy, because of course they believe that the plague is God's punishment, because what the fuck else are they going to believe? So it's really kind of like this extended sort of horrifying sequence of, with like this really memorable, like the crowd is all singing. I don't know what the song was, because you know, it was in Latin, I think. But it's a very memorable sequence that I think, like, I'm pretty sure that scene in Monty Python and the Holy Grail with the monks chanting and beating themselves over the head is meant to be a deliberate reference to this. But it's really like, it's kind of terrifying to see. And they just come through town and this guy stands up and gives this sermon about how, you know, you all you idiots are just like living your lives like nothing's wrong, but you'll probably all be dead by next week. And you should be with us, you know, give up your lives and do nothing but beg God for mercy. And then they wander off carrying all their stuff. And there's like people who are doing the whole march on their knees and, you know, all this like really kind of horrifying stuff.
I mean, in general, I feel like all of the pieces we see is like people are trying to make meaning in something that they don't know how to make meaning in, which is what people do. We're great at that. I do at some point. The main character Antonius has a quote of faith is a torment. Did you know that? It is like loving someone who is out there in the darkness but never appears, no matter how loudly you call. Which I feel like Again, it's hard to imagine why this might have appealed to us so much at this time. Again, I mean, like, people are making meaning as best they can, but frequently the meaning is cruel, right? Like, they can't, like, the stuff with the people beating others and themselves and all of these things of, like, the only thing that they can conceive of is, like, a God who is so cruel that he requires this in order to, you know, lift his hand, so to speak, but, like, or put it down, I guess, depending on how you get it. But, like, that God is not, that God is a monster. Like, that's that is, like, an attempt to create meaning, but, like, it is not a better meaning. But, like, the feeling of any meaning is better than none.
And we do have one of the things. So fairly early on in the movie, after Antonius Block gets into his chess game with death, I think it's the second time we see him. They stop at this church and he goes in for confession, and he unwittingly confessing to death, who he thinks is a priest on the other side of the grate, you know? And so he has this whole confession thing where he's, you know, he's pouring out his heart about, you know, he's tired of having to go on faith alone, and he, you know, wants something concrete in all this. And he talks about how he talks about having encountered death, and he's telling what he thinks is a priest about this. And we find out that the reason why he's doing this, you know, his little game to put off his death is because he's lived a full life. He's gone off and traveled the world and fought for this supposed great cause and all this, but he feels like it's all been wasted, and he wants the opportunity to do one like truly good deed before he dies. Like, that's what he's hoping to find in this reprieve that he's getting from his chess game. And the movie does give him that. He gets that. So it has kind of a, and he clearly sees that as a victory, and, like, you know, kind of willingly goes to meet death in the end once he's accomplished that. So I think there is almost a sort of hopeful note in that respect about, you know, finding your own meaning and making your own impact in the world.
Well, and also that the meaning that again, yes, he's gone and he's fought and he's presumably killed a lot of people, all for this supposedly great cause that he is skeptical of at this point, which probably feels bad, and like all of these things. But, like, you know, eventually, like, they meet up with the husband and wife and their baby, and they spend this afternoon together supposedly eating strawberries, although they're not strawberries, and I don't.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because they almost look more like raspberries, like they're like that size. Strawberries probably would have been a lot smaller back then, but I did think it was very funny that she specifically talked about how they were the biggest ones she'd ever seen. But that may just be a translation thing. Maybe they don't have strawberries in Sweden. There may have been a different type of berry that it just translated that way.
Yeah. Well, I thought, and again, it was
one of Bergman's most famous movies is called Wild Strawberries. So, I don't know.
Right, and like that movie came out the same year as this. So Wild Strawberries was the same year.
Oh, interesting. I didn't remember that.
Honestly, yes, they were very small, but I could say that, like, strawberries were probably smaller than back then. That's fine. But they were eating the whole thing.
Yes, unless she had gone through and trimmed off all of the. Yeah, I had the same thought. But, you know, maybe they did that back then. You can't throw away that, you know, there's probably nutrients in the stem. You can't just throw that away. I don't know. I don't know what exactly they were.
But the point is that they're sitting on the hill. They're eating strawberries from this bowl. They're sharing a communal bowl of milk from a cow in this beautiful spring summer day. And, like, and he finds peace in this moment of, like, genuine companionship, and, you know, probably, I think, seeing the child is part of it, like a next generation sort of thing, and, like, that, like, there are people, these people are living their lives as best they can, they love each other, they're raising their child, and, like, this is, like, the moment of reprieve that he finds. He has this whole speech about how he's gonna remember this day as a moment of peace, and, like, and I think that, I don't know, I think this is a lot of what comes up in all kinds of different ways in this period of Bergman's work, of, like, look, there probably is no God, and there probably is no, like, greater meaning beyond this, but, like, the only protection, like, and people respond to the lack of meaning that we have in all kinds of ways, and they become cynical, or they become cruel, or they become any of these things. But the only real, like, thing that feels like meaning or peace or any kind of protection is, like, compassion with other people. And, like, that it's really hard to, like, shift to that out of this, like, giant cosmic plan sort of thing. But that actually the thing that matters is just these, like, extremely small moments. Again, I can't imagine why this movie appealed to me so much when I was young.
Yeah, it all, I mean, it has this great sort of, like, road movie structure almost, which is the thing that I almost always like, where, you know, they're traveling from place to place and meeting different people, and they're, you know, and there's some very, like, one of the things that's, it, like, because, you know, death is sort of, like, traveling with them, kind of, but of course death is a very busy person in this place and period, and every once in a while you get to see him. The thing with him cutting down the tree that the guy was in is one of my favorite bits in the movie. Like, this other actor that had been with them after having talked his way out of being beaten to death by the blacksmith, goes to climb a tree to rest and thinks he's safe, and hears a saw going, and he's like, oh, there's workers in the woods. And then he looks down, and death is down there sawing at the tree with an axe. And it's so funny. Like, he tries to, he's like, hey, I'm in this tree. He's like, oh, I know. Just, like, sawing away at it. And it's so good.
Feels like cheating a little bit, but whatever.
Well, death is a cheat, as we find out, because in that scene where he's, like, pretending to be the priest to hear Block's confession, his reason for doing that is to try to get Block to tell him what his chess strategy is going to be. So that's an interesting thing, too. Like, death as a character, death does not play fair in even, like, very literal sense.
Does he put the pieces back wrong at the end?
That's a good question, and I don't know.
That hadn't occurred to me until you were saying
this. It occurred to me this time, because that's part of the, so that during their final sort of encounter over the chessboard, it's this big group of them now. It's Block and his squire, and this woman that he's picked up, and it's the blacksmith and his wife, and it's the actors and their child. They're all camping together in the woods. And the Yoff, the actor, sees death playing chess with him, because he has this ability to see these visions, and so he sees him and it's like, they're engrossed in this game, we got to get away, because, you know, death is following this guy, we shouldn't be with him. And Block knows, he's clearly his purpose in the way he's playing the game here is to delay death long enough for this family to escape. This is the truly good deed that he gets to do. And part of what he does is he kind of, like, does a turnaround and knocks over a bunch of the chess pieces with his cloak. And it's like, I don't remember where they were, but death is like, it's okay, I remember. And he sets them back up and immediately wins the game. And so that occurred to me as well, that, like, maybe he did set them back up in a way that cheated, but it just did, you know, because Block had gotten the chance to do his good deed. He didn't, you know, he'd got what he wanted, so he didn't care, maybe. I don't know. I don't know if the shots, if you get shots in the movie where you can confirm that, because the movie's not particularly interested in the chess strategy. Like, there's really not a lot of specific shots of the board or anything, but I'll bet someone's done that. I'll bet someone's gone through and done, like, a frame by frame to see if he put them back in the same places.
That honestly hadn't occurred to me.
I think it could be that he put them back correct, though, because if Block realized that he was about to lose and his, you know, his whole goal was to delay him, so he might have just knocked over the pieces to delay him. But,
well, and when that happens, he says, you know, death's like, okay, like, next time I see you, I'm gonna be taking you and your friends, and he says something like, and will you give your answers? Because, like, yes, he's ready to go for it, but, like, he still wants to know. And death is like, I don't have any answers. And he's like, so you truly don't know anything? And death says, I am unknowing. And that, like, there is no answers in death. There's nothing to find. There's nothing to, you know, there's no way to know. And I think that's, because, again, like, yes, he has resigned himself to that, he has done his good deed, he's willing to, but he still wants answers. Yeah.
But, you know, I guess in a way that is an answer, right? And that, you know, maybe that satisfied him. I don't know. But, so, yeah, we do eventually, he arrives back home to his wife, and they all sit down to have dinner together. And while they're eating, Death comes and knocks at the door, and you know, they all see him this time and know what's happening. And then we get a scene of the actors again, seeing the famous Dance of Death sequence, where we have Death leading them along a hilltop.
Well, just Yoff. His wife is like, oh, you and your visions, and just like wanders off with the kid. Although she believed them enough that when he said he saw Death and they had to leave, that she did go. But yeah, and so like they're dancing across the thing. Death is pulling them in tow, but you know, the actor and the two actors and their child do get. In Ebert's review, he talks about them being named Mary and Joseph. So maybe Yoff is and that there was a child. I don't know. That's what Ebert says in his great movies.
Yeah, her name is Mia, which I guess is probably a related name.
Yeah, I don't know. I was like, well, that's not what they're called in the movie, but I can see the. And I mean, at the beginning, the first vision we see him have is of the Christ child and the Virgin playing in the field together. There is clearly supposed to be like some sort of correlation. But yeah, so they have the opportunity to go off and live life for however much longer they get to do that. Because Death could show at any time. You never know. Anyway, I mean, it's a great movie. It's like 95 minutes. It's not long.
Yeah, that was part. I was a little surprised when I realized that. Because in my head, I was expecting it to probably be like a little over 2 hours or something. And then I looked and I thought, oh, it's only 95 minutes. He fits so much in. To the 95 minutes, like, it's really kind of a movie that has a bit of everything, and it's, yeah, I mean, like I said, I think it's a masterpiece. It's a movie that anyone who's like has an active interest in like film as an art form should definitely watch at some point.
Also, if you are curious about more of Bergman, or if you like have watched one or two and haven't been so sure about it, this is honestly this is his best entry point, realistically.
I think so too. Unless, I mean, at least of his earlier stuff, I guess for some people, you know, maybe like some of his later, like maybe Fanny and Alexander has probably been an entry point for a lot of people. Although I still haven't seen that one, but yeah, I think at least of his earlier stuff, because he did definitely seem to go through. Distinct periods in his filmmaking, but
Ebert refers to his filmmaking career as having an arc that the films he made before, like what we have seen the most of is really like the midpoint in his career. Like he spent the beginning of his career sort of trying to do what everyone else was doing, and that didn't work out super well for him.
The earliest movie of his I think that I've seen is called Smiles of a Summer Night, which is like his first movie I think that people still remember, but it's much more of like a straightforward, like almost like a sex comedy kind of thing. Like there were a lot of those in the 1930s. It's more that kind of thing. And it's good, but it's not, you know, it doesn't approach the kind of brilliance that he got to in his later years, I think.
Yeah. And then his middle section is sort of more this of him like wrestling presumably with his own understanding of the world and the trauma that he endured growing up, which was a lot. I believe his father like locked him in the closet and like, punished him regularly for things. So a lot of trauma around God and faith and religion and all of those kinds of things, which of course is where we jumped on. And we're like, yeah, relatable. And then in his later years, he sort of shifts away from these years are the years he's doing that so directly, like one might almost say without that much finesse a lot of the time. Like he's just like really head on approaching those things. And I think a lot, even the little I have seen of his later career, I think a lot of those same themes are there, but they're much more like gently woven into like a larger picture, which, you know, is sort of the hoped for arc for us all, right?
Yeah. I mean, he went through a period of like some of his like Persona is one of his really well-known movies, which is, it's a lot weirder. It's less plot driven, I think. From what I've seen, it's been a long time since I've seen any of it. I tended to be less into that period of his career. And then I never got into any of the, I think basically like the last decade of his career, he was making movies for Swedish TV, which sounds bad, but didn't have the kind of implications in Sweden that it did in the US. And I think some of them are supposed to be really great, but I haven't got to any of that stuff yet.
Yeah, I am actually curious, because I haven't tried to watch any later Bergman stuff in a while, and I'm curious. I don't know. I guess I'm curious if I've reached the point in my own personal arc that he was, and maybe it lands more for me now. I don't know. Someday we'll figure it out. But that's about all I've got to say on this one. Do you have other thoughts that you wanted to?
I don't think so. I think I can, you know, it's such an interesting movie with, it's just like a series of interesting bits that I feel like, you know, you could kind of go through them and talk about specific things, but I think we covered it pretty well.
Good. Okay, so I don't think we actually came to a conclusion on this. We were talking about it beforehand. Do we want to do a movie for next time, or do we want to do our best of the year wrap up?
I think we should give it one more before we do the best of the year. I feel like I just need a little more time.
All good. Okay, well, in that case, if we are finding another movie, we are going out of 27. So...
Okay, what's number 10?
Number 10 is A Cry in the Dark, which is the Meryl Streep one about the dingoes ate my baby. Joel's looking so confused.
Yeah, no, that's weird because I've never seen that movie.
Okay, maybe you weren't here when we watched it.
I feel like this is the second time that's happened in this thing. I can't remember what the other one was, but I feel like that happened with something else, too. There was a movie that I would have sworn I hadn't seen. I'm looking it up right now to see if I've rated it. No, I don't have it. Yeah, I don't think I ever saw this, so I must have missed this week for some reason.
Maybe you did. Okay, well, I saw it, and I wanted to watch it. I think I watched it because of Meryl Streep. I don't think I knew at the time that that was where Oz's Band and Buffy got the Dingoes Ate My Baby name from. Like,
from the look of the picture on Letterboxd, her and Sam Neill both have very funny hair in it.
Accurate. I'm curious what I think of this. I mean, you know, fucking Meryl Streep. Like, obviously, Meryl Streep. We'll talk more about Meryl Streep in our movies that we've watched section here in a bit. But, or I will. But yeah, I remember really loving it, but I haven't seen it for sure since we watched it for group. So I'm curious what I would feel about it now. And what, I think there's a lot of... It is essentially based on a true story in Australia about this woman whose baby disappeared, and she was accused of murdering the child. And she said that she like saw dingoes come and take her child, but she did not respond in the correct way for a grieving mother, and they didn't believe her.
Right, she was like way too calm about it, and also I think is one of those like, if I seem to remember hearing that it's a thing like there. That's not a thing that dingoes do, sneak into homes and steal children. Like,
to be clear, it wasn't a home, it was a tent. They were like camping or something. But yes, it would have been very unusual for a dingo. She's a pastor's wife. So that also comes up. Anyway, those are the things I remember. It's an incredible Meryl Streep performance, because most Meryl Streep performances are incredible Meryl Streep performances. Yeah, I'm curious to watch it again, and apparently you get to watch it for the very first time, so...
Apparently so, yeah. It looks like it's pretty easily available to rent in the usual places, although I was looking it up on Just Watch, which is this app that I use to figure out where things are streaming, and they have it listed under the title Evil Angels, which I've never heard that title for it before, but if anyone is trying to find it and has difficulty, it might be worth checking under that.
Weird, maybe that was the Australian title for it?
Maybe, I don't know. Letterboxd just has it listed as A Cry in the Dark.
Wild. Know. Okay, well, we'll do that one then. All right. So last time you were very upset that we did not get to talk about more television. Do you want to start with talking about television?
Yeah, we can start with TV. Do you want to start or should I?
Well, you were the one who was very upset to not be able to talk about things, so I feel like it should be you. This sounds like I'm being passive aggressive, but I'm really not.
I mostly just because I don't like I go off my Letterboxd diary for the movies, but because TV isn't recorded there, I tend to forget about TV stuff that I've watched. So that was part of why I wanted to try to squeeze some of it in.
Do you use TV time to mark your TV?
No.
I use that.
I'm not familiar. Apparently Letterboxd is going to start letting you log TV this year at some point.
I don't know how I feel about it.
Yeah, me neither. I hope they... I'm okay with them having it. I hope that they have it so that you can log season by season and not episode by episode. Because the thing that most people seem to be concerned about, and that seems like a legitimate concern, is that their whole feed is going to get clogged up with one person they follow is... binging Parks and Rec, and you know they're gonna have 15 entries in a row that are just episodes of what, you know, whatever. So I'm hoping that they just have it by season, but I don't know. I don't know how it's.
We'll see.
At any rate, a couple TV things that I have been watching that I think you've watched or at least watched part of. I did start on Murder at the End of the World. Which, have you watched that all the way through?
Morgan and I did watch that all the way through. We watched it week to week.
Okay, so I have one episode left. I was really hoping to finish it before we recorded today, but I'm six episodes in. There's one left. I've been pretty into it. It's a, like, it's very like, the main character is very, it's basically Elizabeth Salander without all the hard edges, which I'm not mad at that. I think she's a good character. It's an interesting story.
We didn't have to watch her get brutally raped even one time. So that's there's true. That.
That's true. And Clive Owen is in it. And like I think because of Children of Men, which we talked about extensively on here, I've always loved Clive Owen, even though I feel like he hasn't been in that many things that I like. I don't know if that's me or if he just hasn't had the career that he deserved. But
I think he probably hasn't. But also, my main reason is that I had a huge crush on Clive Owen when I was young, so I watched a lot of things he was in. But yeah, I don't think he has gotten to do a lot of the work that he could.
Yeah, he never seems like he never really broke out as like a lead the way that I think he probably deserved. I think he's a really good actor, and he has kind of a fun. He's playing like a billionaire tech guy in this movie, in this show, which is. You know, it's probably not his most challenging role, but he's kind of fun in it. I don't see. I'm curious. I was really hoping to finish it because I can't decide if I think it's going downhill as it goes on, and I'm curious how you felt about how it played out. Because obviously it is a mystery. He brings this group of people out to this. He calls it a hotel, but that's not really what it is. Like this resort place that he built out in the wilderness in Iceland. That's like this super high tech run by AI thing for this like sort of conference of like great minds to like get together and discuss the future of technology and how it can help save the world from global warming and warfare and all of this stuff. And of course, people immediately start dying, start being murdered. And the main character is like, I mean, she's basically like an amateur sleuth who solved a serial killing and wrote a book about it and so became like sort of mid-level famous for that, and she gets invited to this thing and so she's trying to figure out what's going on. I have really enjoyed it for the most part, but I feel like episode six kind of centered around what I think was supposed to be like a big... like perspective shifting plot twist, and it just felt like the most obvious, like of course that's what's like it would have been weirder if that wasn't what was happening. So at this point I'm a little skeptical of how it's actually going to end, and based on your looks here I'm guessing you maybe weren't crazy about the way it plays out in the end.
I did think the ending was stupid. We will see. I mean, like, I enjoyed the ride and it was fine. To be clear, like Britt Marling and her partner, whose name starts with a Z, I don't remember his name. Anyway, I have often not been like fully satisfied with where they land things. I feel like I go into their projects like looking forward to enjoy the ride, but like accepting that maybe the end will not be like. Like, I feel like my favorite project of theirs was Sound of My Voice, which I loved a lot when I watched it. But like,
I still haven't seen that one.
But like, Another Earth was one that they did that like.
That was kind of their breakout thing, I think. And I liked that one quite a lot.
I liked a lot of it. I thought it was kind of dumb at the end. Like, I don't feel a lot of the times like they fully land their mini like ideas, or they sometimes like the ideas feel really out there and then the ending feels not at all out there, and then that sort of, but like I feel like I went into it sort of with that expectation, so like I did not like the end, but I wasn't mad I'd watched the show. I really liked the guy who plays her ex-boyfriend.
Bill? Yeah, me too. He's really good. I don't know that actor. I'm not familiar with him, but he's really
good. You just saw him in Iron Claw. He was one of the brothers.
Wait,
in
was
Iron
he
Claw.
Really? Which one?
He was the one who went to Japan first. I don't want to spoil, but like who the first one.
Oh, like the one that kind of got ahead of Efron's character?
Yes, the one who was throwing up at some
point. Oh, that's funny. I didn't even recognize him. Apparently, I'm looking at his filmography now. His name is Harris Dickinson, and it looks like he's been in a couple other things. He was in, he was in the Maleficent movie, apparently. Apparently, he was in See How They Run, which I hated. He's been kind of an up-and-comer for the last few years, it looks like. But he's really good in the show, at any rate.
He is. He's really good, and him and the flashback relationships of, her, like, shots of her and him are what I liked most about it. So I will say that in terms of is the mystery satisfying to me personally, no. But I do think that Bill is a really interesting character that I'm not sure that I have seen before. Honestly, it wasn't something that I could not easily fit him into any particular archetype. He's gentle and sweet in many ways. He is a former addiction issue. He is... like, she is the one who is harsher in that. I don't want to give too much away, but, like, their relationship and his character, I think, were my favorite parts of the show. Enough of it was interesting and unique to me that I didn't mind too much that the mystery sort of let me down, I guess. And maybe you'll love it. Who knows? But
it also has we're spending a lot of time on this, but it has a few things, like... One thing I've heard, it got delayed by a couple months, apparently. Like, it was supposed to be released a couple months earlier. And the speculation that I've heard about that is because AI plays kind of like a central role in the plot, and it's portrayed fairly positively. At least, I don't, maybe that won't end up being the case, but at least in the early episodes, there's like this sort of AI assistant that this guy has created. And it's just like helpful, and there's a filmmaker who's part of this group talking about how his next movie was made in collaboration with AI, and everyone's like excited about it, and it's like everyone's acting like it's like, you know, and but there's one thing in particular, this is like sort of minor spoilers, but there's one scene in particular that stuck out to me in the episode where her and Sean leave the compound to go out and try to look for stuff, and then the storm is coming, so they have to get back, and their snowmobile dies. The way that whole thing plays out, it's probably been a little bit since you've watched it now, but like, so they're
like a month.
Their snowmobile dies, and Sean is like, they're in like these high tech, they're basically like space suits for the Earth that they can withstand extreme conditions, and she's, you know, don't worry about it, we're not that far. We've got the suits. We've just got to walk. We'll be okay. And so they start walking. And as they're walking, they come across this building that is like connected to the thing. And there's a vehicle there that they're able to take. And so they're driving the rest of the way. And Sean is driving like a fucking maniac for no reason. Like, because literally she was like, we have time to walk. We're fine. And like, sure, they found a car. Obviously, they're going to take the car rather than walk. But there is no rush. And like, they're fortunate that this car is capable of driving on the snow or on the ice, because there's, it's a road. But like, and she's clearly driving in like unsafely in normal conditions for no reason. And there's no like, there's no attempt to explain it. Like, our main character doesn't, like, she looks kind of nervous about it, but she doesn't say anything about it. And then they crash. And, like, it felt like something that was written by AI. It felt like AI wrote a script where it felt like it needed an exciting bit at this point in the episode. So it put in a car crash. That's what it felt like to me. Because it didn't make any sense. And no one ever questions it. Like, why were you driving like that? What was going on?
Interesting.
So there's a few things like that in the show where I kept thinking, like, okay, this is like a mystery show. Surely we're going to find out that there's a reason for this weird thing that just happened, but it doesn't seem like there is. So I have a few kind of issues with it like that, that it's probably not written by an AI. It's probably just not very strong writing, because the way the rest of that episode plays out, like the main character gets knocked out in the car crash, and like it plays into the whole rest of the season, the fact that she has this head injury and stuff. So like, it does contribute to the plot going forward, but they should have come up with a better way for it to happen because it doesn't make any sense.
I will say, in terms of the AI element, that I don't want to give any spoilers. I will say that I do not think that they make any compelling, interesting, or new commentary on AI by the end of the show. That's where I will leave it at. But yeah, so, you know, if you have watched Britt Marling stuff before and you have, like, enjoyed her vibes, like, it's a fun enough 7 episodes or whatever to watch through.
I think it's definitely, like, less weird than most of her stuff. Has kind of a sci-fi element to it. And other than, like, the sort of futuristic AI tech, there isn't really anything like that in this one, at least not in the first 6 episodes. It's more like the girl with the dragon tattoo is, and, you know, or maybe like a Poirot mystery, almost like the sort of locked room, you know, specific group of people. We know one of them is a killer kind of story. It plays out fairly straightforwardly in that sense, I think, as opposed to things like the OA, which sure. I only ever saw the first season of, and I still think that the way the first season of that show wrapped up might be the most offensive thing I've ever seen. But a lot of people feel differently. A lot of people love that show. Anyway, so that's one of the things that I've been watching. But I have also been watching the Monarch, the Legacy of Monsters Godzilla spin-off show on Apple TV.
Morgan and Eric and I are watching that, but we kind of got sidetracked. I think we watched like 2 episodes or something. We are going to watch more. We've been watching. Morgan had never seen any of the Monsters Universe stuff, so like we've been slowly watching through that so that we can get to, so that they'll be caught up to date by the time Godzilla X Kong comes out. The trailers for which make me giggle like an insane
person. It looks great.
So fun, and I love it. Anyway, I just really, like, I feel like Monsters Universe is criminally under-talked about, I have to say, because they have done such an amazing job. They get incredible actors who are having so much fun in the roles. They just lean all the fuck the way in into the goofy, silly shit, and it's so fun, and the monsters are so cool, and I feel like it just doesn't get talked about that much, even though it's clearly been a very successful franchise.
Well, yeah, they're still making these crazy expensive movies, and it's obviously they're making money, but yeah, people don't. I feel like it should, at the very least, it should be getting talked about the way that maybe like the Fast and the Furious franchise gets talked about, like that level. You know, they're not great art, they're not gonna be winning any Oscars, but like people obviously love them,
right? Like they're really fun.
Yeah. At least people want to go see them. I don't know how many people really love them, but people want to go see them. At least
I love them.
At any rate, I think I'm 5 episodes into the show.
Okay, so you're ahead of us.
And I have been really enjoying it. I felt like it started out a little bit slow. I don't know how you felt about the first couple episodes.
I liked them all. I don't know.
Has Kurt Russell showed up yet? Because he shows up, I think, in the 3rd episode.
Yeah, and I don't think we've seen
it. Obviously, having Kurt Russell show up is going to be a big boost to anything. And
it was fun when he showed up in the Fast and Furious franchise.
I don't think I knew that. But at any rate, whoever it was that convinced Kurt Russell and his son to play the same character at different ages, I hope they've gotten a raise. Like, I always forget that I think it's Wyatt Russell is his name. I always forget that he's Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn's son.
Also in the Fast and the Furious movies.
That makes sense, I guess. But like, I've seen him in a handful of things, and I always like him well enough. I like seeing him. He's not Kurt Russell, but you know, he's good. I always like seeing him, and I saw he shows up early in this show. I was like, okay, this is, you know, familiar face that I like. That's cool. And I hadn't even known Kurt Russell was going to be in it until I noticed his name in the credits. I was like, oh, shit. Well, that's good. You know, that'll be something to watch at least, even if the show sucks, whatever. And I didn't put it together until much later that, oh, they're playing the same character because the show takes place in these 2 different timelines.
He did show up. So we may have watched 3. Yes, I do remember.
He may have showed up at like the very end of the 2nd episode. I can't remember. But at any rate, all that's fun. Kurt Russell is, you know, he's always fun to watch. And I personally, I think that like the sort of human drama element of the show is better than anything in the movies has been, that's not a criticism of the movies, because, as you know, anyone who's into those movies knows that they get great actors to do like fun stuff, but the human drama is not it's all extremely secondary as far as it goes. But obviously they don't have the budget for a TV show for the for 90% of the focus to be on giant monsters running around. Although you do see more giant monsters than I thought might be the case. There's been basically at least one in every episode so far.
I was going to say, that's what I feel like I noticed when we were watching the first couple episodes, is that there was like one big set piece monster per episode. And I was like, all right, I can deal with that. That's good.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. I don't know. I think it's 10 episodes, so I've still got a ways to go. But I've been really enjoying it, and I think it's getting better as it goes, at least so far. So.
Well, that's great to hear. I think Morgan and Eric were not like super crazy about the human drama part in the first couple. I was like, I don't know, for this thing, this seems pretty good. Like, it's not like,
right. I mean, it's not Succession, right? Like, it's not like the best thing you've ever seen or whatever. But I think it's pretty solid. I think all the actors are really good. It has dog snorting over here. What's that actress's name who plays? She plays the character of May in the show, the hacker girl in Tokyo. Maybe you haven't met her. Maybe she doesn't show up in the first.
Oh, wait. Yes. No, I have. Sorry. It just took me a minute to put it together. I don't know her name off the top of my head, however.
I can't remember her name either, but I've seen her in a couple things and she's really good. I guess I should look it up because I hate talking.
Kiersey Clemons?
Yeah, Kiersey Clemons. She's always really good and I think she's good in the show and like her character has interesting things going on. If you're at all following the monster universe thing, it's definitely worth checking out. It's doing kind of a cool dual timeline thing where you've got characters in like the beginning of the Monarch program in like the early 50s and then characters not quite modern day. It's like in the immediate aftermath of the first Godzilla attack. So like 6 years ago now or something, whenever the first movie came out. But it's good. It's fun. I'm really enjoying it. I'm looking forward to watching more of it.
Yeah, I think, and also if you haven't watched any of the MonsterVerse stuff, but it seemed like a fun thing to do. The only, like, no movies are required to watch it. The only thing that takes place, like, we watched the first Godzilla movie, but because the Monarch show, or part of one of the timelines functionally starts like right around the time of one of the Godzilla attacks in those movies. So, but honestly, even if you watched it without any of the movies, you would probably be fine.
Yeah. I mean, you know what happens when Godzilla attacks, right? Like whatever comes to mind, that's what happened. So, and they're all, you know, I think they're all new characters. I don't think any of the, we get one brief scene at the beginning of the first episode with John Goodman's character
Skull Island.
Was he Skull Island he was in? Yeah. But other than that, that was basically a cameo appearance to kind of set up some of what happens in one of the timelines. But other than that, I think it's all new.
Yeah, I think so.
New characters.
Yeah. There's the whole bridge thing is a thing that the bridge thing in the first episode where she's on a bus with school kids is something that we saw from different angles in the Godzilla movie. So she is in like that attack was in the Godzilla movie and they have placed her in that. So I always say
that's cool. Yeah. I've only seen them once each and I saw them in theaters. So I haven't seen the first Godzilla movie since whenever that was that it came out. So
neither had I until we rewatched it, but it's been fun to rewatch them. So, I have very few TV, but I will give a little TV and then we will do movies. I have been, the new Percy Jackson television show is up on Disney. There are 4 episodes of it out so far.
I was going to talk about that one too, because I figured you'd been watching it. Yeah. I thought there were, is there only 4? I thought there was 5, but at any rate, yeah, there's either 4 or 5, however many.
There's 5. You're right. And it's so good.
It's so fucking good. Yeah, no, I've been like every episode it's ended and we're like, that was really good. Like consistently kind of amazed by how good it is.
Not just good, but getting better. Like I think each episode has really been a step up. I have to say, side note, Jason Mantzoukas for, what's his face? The god of wine or whatever.
Yeah, Mr. D.
Dionysus. Is inspired casting. Beautiful, beautiful casting. But honestly, everyone's pretty good. I'm not like the kids in the first 2 episodes were a little bit shaky, I felt like at times, particularly the kid who played Grover, but has been just
he's nailing it. And I think the kid who plays Percy has been great.
Fantastic.
So good. Like, you know, it just like a way better than you would expect from someone his age, and way better than like he needed to be for this show, I think.
100%. And I think that like the kid who plays Grover, who incidentally is a child right now, but will be a beautiful young man when he gets older. Those eyes are something else. Great casting, guys. But like he had a scene in this last week's episode that was really like rely, and he killed it. Absolutely
with,
killed
with
it.
Aries?
With Aries.
Yeah, that was good. See, that was, I think particularly in this recent episode, there's some like, it's been a while since I've read the first book, but they made some like fairly significant changes that feel like major improvements from what I remember of the book. And like, you know, May and I have been reading the books for a while. I don't think we've talked about them on mic before, but you and I have talked about them, and we've been like really enjoying the books. They're fun. But like, I feel like the show is, the dialogue is mostly like, the humor is better than it was, at least in the earlier books. I felt like a lot of the humor was kind of like eye rolly. It's mostly funnier in the show than it was in the books. There's a thing that consistently was irritating to us in the books, is just how fucking dumb Percy could be about situations. Like, it takes him forever to figure out what's going on. And I feel like the show almost, like, it recognizes that he's being dumb and almost, like, kind of, like, makes fun of him for it almost.
Okay, I would like to...
I appreciate it. I think it's great.
I would like to throw out a note of slightly more kindness, that Percy is in fifth grade.
I know that, but what bothers me about it in the book is not that he can't figure it out. It's that the book is clearly written
for fifth graders.
Okay, but like, it's, I would have been able to figure out what was going on in fifth grade because I'd read a book before. Like, you're supposed to share his revelation when he figures out what's happening, and it always just felt. Like, and you know, it's not just that it's a young adult book. I've read a lot of young adult books.
Okay, but this is an important point though. This is Percy Jackson. The first ones are not young adult books. They are middle grade books. They are intended for younger children who are like 7 to 10 years old, which is how old his kid was when he was writing it. And look, you read a lot of things, but one of the reasons that he created Percy was because his son wasn't that much of a reader because he was dyslexic and he was. Percy are great books for kids who have not read them.
That's all fine, but I found that very irritating reading, particularly the earlier books, and I feel like the show handles it better than the books did.
The show is definitely for a like broader age audience. I will say also that a lot of that stuff shifts correctly as Percy gets
older.
I'm
sure it does, yeah.
But also, like, you know, he wrote those books 20 years ago. Like, and well, I think
that's part of like, he's very involved in the show, and I'm sure that a lot of the improvements are coming from him, because so I have no doubt that that's the case.
So I'm
still like, I mean, he's been writing these books for ages. There's a ton of them now. I think we're reading the fourth one right now. May and I are. So, you know,
you're still in the first set.
Yeah. It's the one that we're reading right now is the one with the labyrinth. I think it's the fourth one.
Yeah. I so hope, you know, we live in this god awful hellscape age of television where things get canceled all the time for no reason. And I'm just like, there is so much material here and they're doing such a great job. Could you please just not cancel it, Disney? Like, could you please just like continue? Because there is so much to work with here. My understanding is the first season will be the first book. And then
I assume so. Yeah.
And they're having to cut some things out, of course, because it's like a 8 to 10 episode season or something. But like, and I really think like Morgan has occasionally been like, I wish it had been a little longer. It feels so rushed. And I was like, yes, I get that. I wish for more. But also, honestly, this does pretty much line up with the pace that the books run at. Like, they are kind of just constantly running from one adventure to the other, especially in the
books,
earlier ones.
The books are kind of, at least the earlier ones are kind of perfectly suited for like a kind of Monster of the Week-y format, because it's literally like each chapter they encounter a different god or mythological creature that they have to, you know, either work with or overcome in literally every, that's the structure of the book, is every chapter is a different thing until they eventually get to their goal. So it really works. I mean, it's kind of ideal for episodic TV, because you can have, you know, guest appearances from like big name actors who come in and, you know, do one episode or whatever. The guy who plays Ares apparently is a professional wrestler. I was not familiar with him, but he's really good. Like, he's just really fun in that role. I'm looking forward to seeing some of the other gods show up. There haven't been very many so far, but
Timothy Amundsen showed up as Hephaestus, which was driving me crazy. I was like, who is it? I couldn't recognize him right away. I had to look it up.
I had to look it up too. I couldn't figure it out.
But I remember him mostly from Gallivant, which Morgan had never seen, so now we're watching Gallivant. But
see, I knew him from Psych, which a long time ago. So I don't think I ever would have figured out who he was if I hadn't looked him up.
But yeah, I mean, they've got a bunch of fun people coming in and playing different roles. All of the kids are crushing it. They're absolutely crushing it. And
well, that's right. That's the, like, they have, you know, solid actors that you recognize playing more minor roles. But like, if the kids sucked, then the whole thing wouldn't hold together very well. But they're all so good.
They're so good. I cried at the last episode, and like they really, the whole throne thing, I won't get into that, but they really nail again, because the important thing is not that, and especially as adults, is not that we think that Percy is going to die or is going to have something horrible happen to him, but that he believes it and is willing to make a sacrifice and just sold the hell out of it. Just incredible work. So much fun. Please, for the love of fuck, Disney, just like keep going for a while.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't heard anything about, in, you know, there's no way to know with streaming shit, like how popular it is or whatever, but there really is a ton of potential. They could make a whole empire out of this thing. I did have the thought in this recent episode where they were going into the tunnel at the water park, and then, you know, went down a waterfall or whatever. I was like, they're rebuilding a ride at Disneyland right now to make it a Percy Jackson ride, aren't they? Like, I don't know which one they're going to redo It's a Small World to make it a Percy Jackson ride or something. Because it kind of had that feel to it, the way it was playing out in the episode. But
I mean, they fucking should.
Yeah, I mean, that would be great. Like, if it's that, if it hits that hard and they can, you know, they can kind of build the whole thing around it, I would be really into it.
I mean, Riordan remains, at this point, the top best-selling young adult author in the world right now, and has done a lot of good with that. Although my understanding is he maybe hasn't landed perfectly on the Gaza thing, unfortunately. But
I have not heard about that. But
regardless, has been very, very supportive of a number of communities. Has been really open to correction and critique. And I just, if anyone deserves like even more of a boost, I would love to see it be Uncle Rick. So great work. And if anyone's not watching, please go watch it. Please go watch it. it's really great. And more people should be watching it, because of course they haven't fucking advertised it for shit. Just like they don't advertise anything for shit. It's fine. Anyway. And then the only other thing I wanted to mention, I started watching The Curse, but I don't know that I want to talk about that a ton right now. Actually, you know what? No. Oh, well, okay. The only other thing I will mention is that the Comfort show, because I can't remember if I brought it up before, the Comfort television show that I have been watching, I watched all the way through once and then have been rewatching it with Eric, is Apple has a Frog and Toad show up. And it's so soft and lovely and gentle. And I am Toad and Morgan is Frog. and it's just, it's a lovely, charming little show. It looks like they're planning on making another season, hopefully. So hopefully there'll be more of it. So if you're just looking for something that's very soft and gentle and sweet, the animation is lovely. There's a lot of big names doing, you know, individual voices and stuff in it. Anyway, just check it out. It's great. Anyway, we should probably talk about movies because we're over an hour in.
Yeah, when we just spent 40 minutes talking about three TV shows. Yeah.
This is why we couldn't do it last week.
Do you want to just continue on through your movies, or do you want to throw it back to me?
Yeah, I can continue on. So we recorded at the end of December, right?
Yeah, it looks like our last recording was on the 31st.
Okay, good for us. Anyway, so there's always the first movie of the year thing that I feel a lot of pressure about for no reason. I mean, there's no impact if I watch a bad first movie of the year, but like it always feels like I'm setting a tone for something. Anyway, so I couldn't decide what to do, and I was stressing out about it. We were supposed to go watch The Iron Claw, but then I was like, oh, Joel says it's so sad, and I don't know if that's the note I want to start my year out with. So we ended up, Morgan picked one. It's the 1970 animated version of The Phantom Tollbooth, which is not a book I ever read growing up, although I know a lot of
people. Yeah, me neither. Yeah, it's a big deal for a lot of people, but
Anyway, it's a weird psychedelic 60s, 70s animation. The animation is cool. I don't have any connection to the source material, but it was an interesting little thing. It was like 90 minutes. It was good. And then the next day we went to go see The Iron Claw. Oh my God, Joel. I was not prepared. I knew it was sad. Largely because you told me. I hadn't really heard that much, and I'm grateful that you did, because otherwise I probably would have gone to see it on Monday. But it is so sad, and it is so tragic, that if it was not based on a true story, some of which they actually cut out of the story.
Oh, yeah. You even just like basic Wikipedia research, the reality of this family was so much sadder than what you get in the movie, which is like a parade of misery.
Just absolutely devastating. Unfathomably devastating. Incredible movie. Incredible movie. So well done. So well put together. Zac Efron really does do an amazing job. But all of them do. They're all doing great. I think that there is an element of the way, like, yes, there is the fucking father who's the piece of shit sports dad in a lot of ways. But I think that the way they play in how their mother contributed to that abuse is really unique in an interesting way and like feels very real. But like, it's just like at the end of the day, these people were not willing to take even the slightest bit of responsibility for their children, but they were more than happy to take all the credit. It's like God. But anyway, it's devastating. It's devastating. I cried so hard. I don't know if I'll ever be able to watch it again, but it might be on my top 10 of the year. So it's hard to say. It was a great movie, but Jesus Christ, go in prepared because it is.
See, that's interesting. It sounds like you liked it more than I did. Like I thought it was a real good, solid movie. And you know, it just insanely sad. But I wouldn't have called it a great movie. It's definitely not in my top of the year. So that's interesting that you. I guess I don't know. Maybe it's not surprising. It surprises me a little bit that it landed better for you than for me. But
I mean, I love a movie about complex and devastating family dynamics. That's pretty. That's up my alley. Anyway, so I loved it. But I genuinely don't know if I'll ever watch it again. Well, I guess I might if we do our future podcast. So then the next day we watched Quiz Lady because I was looking for something lighter.
May and I talked about watching that, but we haven't gotten around to it. Is it good?
It's fun. It's a real fun ride. It's a role for Sandra Oh that I feel like we very rarely get to see her play.
Right. She gets to be the goofy one, right?
Yeah, she's like the goofy, out of control, chaotic sister and is having a great time with it. Yeah, absolutely. It's a very fun, like 100 minutes or so. Great time. It's up on Hulu. People should check it out. Then we watch Kong Skull Island. And then I don't have a lot more to say about that, except that I enjoy Kong Skull Island. and then we watched Anatomy of a Fall because that was coming up. I liked it a lot. I liked it a lot and it stuck with me. I think it's hard to like Sandra Huber's performance is so incredible. Sandra Huber is so incredible. And I think I need to see it again, but it was really, really good. And then Morgan and I were determined we're going to do better this time. We're actually going to finish our Criterion Challenge this year. We're going to do it. We'll see. We didn't finish last year. But we watched our first Criterion film of the year, which was Sancho the Bailiff, which is also in the book. So that's convenient.
Yeah, I watched that a couple months ago. I talked about it on here.
Yeah, it's good. I don't know that I love...
Also an overwhelmingly sad movie. I mean, like a archetypal tragedy kind of movie.
Very sad. Why do you think the movie is called Sancho the Bailiff?
That's a good question because my understanding from what I remember is that it's based on like sort of, I don't know if a folk tale is the right term, but it's like a very, very old story in Japanese culture. And maybe the bailiff had a more significant role in the original version of the story. That's my best guess. I don't know. Cause he really isn't even a character. I mean, he's barely a character.
Yeah, I mean, he's there, but not that much. I don't know. He has the craziest beard I've ever seen on a human person. It's like an anime beard. It's like it just like sticks straight out at all angles that it's facing. It's wild. Anyway, it was a good movie. This classic film was good. And exciting news. And then we watched this. Then we watched the second thing on our Criterion list, which was the original 310 to Yuma.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen that in a long time, but I did really like that one.
A lot gayer than I was anticipating.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that is, I think, more common in classic Westerns than a lot of people realize. Yeah.
I think that's really true. But Morgan and I just spent the whole movie being like, okay, you can't, they didn't write that accidentally. He's like laying in bed telling him that he, anyway, it was really fun though. I had a good time. I enjoyed it. It was good. And then we watched Flora and Son, the new John Carney movie that is up on.
That's another one that's been on my list to catch up with because I do really like most of John Carney's stuff, but I haven't watched it.
I have traditionally enjoyed John Carney, but not necessarily loved John Carney. I've seen Sing Street a couple times. I had an ex who was really into it, and so I rewatched it with them. And I've seen multiple of his movies, which I have generally given like 4 stars, like solid films, films I really like. I think this is the one that has the most. I ended up giving it 4.5. It really landed for me. The mother-son relationship and the complications of that and the way it played really, really worked for me. The main character is, I can't remember her name, but she's Bono's child.
I didn't know that. Has she acted before?
I don't know. I don't. She did a great job acting wise, and she has a lovely voice. I liked a lot of the music in it. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is playing this other character that I'm really glad it was Joseph Gordon-Levitt, because there were so many times I wanted to punch this dude in the face, but I like Joseph Gordon-Levitt so much that like it sort of mitigated it. Not in like he was a horrible person, just he was kind of pretentious about shit in ways that annoyed me.
He seems like an obvious choice for it. Like, it's weird that they haven't worked together before.
100%. 100%. But it's really lovely. It's really beautiful. The music is good.
It's on Apple, right? I am still hoping to get to that one before making my list for the end of the year.
Yeah, I don't know if it'll land for you as well as it did for me, but I think you will like it. And then I was like, all right, back to the blank checklist. Let's start knocking some stuff out. And I was feeling something. I was like, let's watch The Post, because that seems like a, you know, it's
Spielberg. Oh, right, Meryl Streep. Yeah.
Meryl Streep, Spielberg, a lot of people I like. And it's like a newspaper movie, and I love a newspaper movie. It's a good time. I somehow didn't realize it was by the same people who had done Spotlight. It's not as good as Spotlight, to be clear. The writers. It's not as good as Spotlight, and it probably suffered from coming out a few years after Spotlight and like having that comparison, or maybe the next year, having that comparison naturally be drawn, because it's not as strong as that. But it is really good, honestly.
It was a good movie. I liked it.
I really knew almost nothing about it, and I didn't know that much about the story, and I had no idea that a woman was running the Washington Post at this time period. That's wild. She has an autobiography. I'm going to read it. Anyway, and it did seem as if Spielberg had given almost everyone in the movie a direction of make a weird voice. Not the same weird voice. Not the same anything. But they're all making weird voices.
I don't remember that, but...
It's not even a complaint. I enjoyed it, but it was just kind of funny. Anyway, it's a very solid and enjoyable film, and more people should watch it. And then we watched Dunkirk. I have now seen all of Nolan's movies. I understand it doesn't make sense, but I was a little concerned. I was like, what if I watched Oppenheimer
You're afraid you're going to like Nolan now? Yeah.
What if I became a Nolan stan? I've been such an active Nolan hater for such a long time. I have not become a Nolan stan. We can leave that to the side. I came out of it being like, gosh, what a technically accomplished movie that I sure don't fucking care about. So, you know, whatever.
I still haven't rewatched that one since the theater, but I did really love that one. I think it might be his best movie.
Better than Oppenheimer?
Yeah, I didn't. I'm sure we'll talk about this more in coming episodes. I didn't love Oppenheimer the way a lot of people seem to. Again, I need to watch it. I need to rewatch it. But I really love Dunkirk.
Yeah, fair enough. I might have liked it a little better in theaters, but I think overall it is generally the kind of war film that I just don't. It just doesn't land for me. And then on Friday we went to go see The Book of Clarence. And I have had a religious experience. Not really. I still don't believe in God. But holy shit. I'm dying for you to watch this movie. I'm
excited for it. I just haven't got to it yet. Yeah.
I honestly... So it was me and Eric and Morgan. And Eric and I were having like transcendent experiences. And Morgan almost fell asleep once or twice. it was a real like one of those things of like... You can really be having like two entirely separate experiences sitting directly next to one person. I don't know if it works if you don't have the history. And I'm seeing that in a lot of the reviews that I'm seeing of people being like, I don't understand what he's doing. And don't get me wrong. I didn't fully understand everything he was doing. I have some questions about the ending that I would like to talk about with people. But it may be one of the most brilliant adaptations I've ever seen. I sobbed at the crucifixion scene. I don't fucking remember the last time I cried at a crucifixion walk. He is doing something that is so... Like, he clearly knows this story so well. And he is... I had a moment of genuine revelation, Joel. I had a moment watching this movie where I remembered, and I suspect you remember this too. Do you remember how when we were growing up, we would be told a lot of the time that the reason that the Jews did not recognize Christ as the Messiah is because they were looking for a political Messiah. And that was also what fucked up Judas Iscariot, because he wanted a political Messiah. But Jesus was bringing them something that was so much more important than that.
Right. They were looking for more personal freedom from the empire that was ruling over them rather than a spiritual freedom from sin. That is a common line, yeah.
And I had this moment of remembering that and being like, oh, that was propaganda. That's what that was. That was propaganda. And this story has no power whatsoever if you are telling it from the point of view of the oppressor. And this is why they work so hard to be convinced they are the oppressed. Telling this story from the perspective of a black man making comparisons to like current modern day in various ways. Again, someone who knows this story. So David Oyelowo has a very brief role as John the Baptist in what is, he slaps Clarence across the face twice, and it's extremely, it's funny, but it's also like, this is absolutely who John the Baptist was. Like you don't know that if you don't know, you know? Also, did you realize that Barabbas, what's your impression of who Barabbas was in the Bible? If someone was like, what did Barabbas do? What would you say from what we were taught?
I mean, I think all it says about him was that he was in prison waiting execution for, I think it said he was a murderer and a thief, I think that's all it says about him in the Bible.
It does, except that that's not actually the translation. That's not correct.
That's not surprising. You find all kinds of stuff like that once you start looking into it.
He was a revolutionary. He had been involved in uprisings against Rome. That's why he was on trial. And it sure makes the Jews being like, yeah, bring us back this one, make a lot more sense. Anyway, James Samuel does something really interesting with the character. He makes a character of Barabbas and does something really interesting with that in this. It's incredible. It's amazing. And I'm not sure if it will land for anyone, because evangelicals are going to hate it, obviously. And if you don't have the background, I'm not sure you follow. I think it's brilliant, but I think a very specific crowd is going to know that.
Interesting. Well, I'm excited for it. It is high on my list. I'm still playing catch up with stuff from last year that's playing right now. And
I literally walked out of it being like, did I peak with my first movie of 2024? Is this going to be, and like, you know, who knows? There's a lot of 2024 left, but I can almost guarantee you it's going to be in my top five.
Nice.
So that was thrilling. And then we came back and watched Seven Seal. And then last night when I had the night to myself, I was thinking about Efron because of watching Iron Claw. And I was like, you know, a movie I didn't actually ever watch of Efron's is that one where he was Ted Bundy. It's terrible. Don't watch it.
I remember hearing that was a very divisive movie when it came out, from what I recall. But I never saw it.
I feel like it would be a confusing movie if you didn't know a lot about the Ted Bundy story. The movie constantly undercuts its own momentum by jumping back and forth to different time periods and stuff. Like, it never, like, stays long enough a lot of the time. And, like, I know what happened with Ted Bundy. I watched the stupid fucking 8-episode thing or whatever. And so I was mostly able to follow what was going on. But there were times where I was like, I kind of remember this, but not entirely.
Well, the movie came out at like the same time as that documentary, right? There was kind of like a weird craze about Ted Bundy for a little bit there.
Also, Bundy was hot by like serial killer standards, but he was not fucking Zac Efron. Let's be clear. Also, like, I don't know. It didn't do them any favors to play clips of Bundy at the end of scenes because, like, again, at no point does, like, Efron always, like, you see the charm, but Efron never seems actually genuinely unhinged or scary. And I don't really think that's his fault. That's just not, like, his strength. And I think he was a bad choice for the role. He was just a bad choice. And then...
Stunt casting. It always seemed like stunt casting to me. That's what it sounded like.
And who knows? Maybe it helped raise his profile a little bit in some ways. And maybe that's what got him to Iron Claw, which genuinely, Iron Claw is the perfect casting for Zac Efron, who consistently and always basically only has chemistry with other men. And so for, and like, whatever, him and Lily James, or was it Lily James? I think she is also the girlfriend in the Bundy movie, actually. Anyway, but they're fine. I never felt any particular overwhelming chemistry between them, but between him and his brothers, great work. Honestly, some of you may have seen this running around TikTok, but it is my favorite thing from Ironclaw that I forgot to mention is there's literally a 30 second scene where all the brothers are dancing together. And the way that you can see the other three guys focusing so hard on their steps while Efron is just dancing around like a goddamn fairy is I mean that with all love and no negative connotations, is a delight. Anyway, so I watched that and it was very dumb. But then I was trying to find movies that Morgan had already watched that I needed to. Anyway, I watched Paths of Glory, the Kubrick.
You hadn't seen that one, huh?
Morgan watched it without me last year. And anyway, I
did. So you did two war movies by directors that everyone but you loves. And the interesting coincidence, I assume. I assume that wasn't intentional.
I mean, it was over a couple days, but yeah. I really liked Paths of Glory. I didn't love it, but I definitely enjoyed it. It was compelling. It was fast moving, and I felt, I was into it. I liked it.
I think it's one of Kubrick's best. I think it's fantastic. I really love, whatever the hell his name is, the main guy in it,
Kirk Douglas.
Yeah, he's really great in it. I think it's one of the better performances in a Kubrick movie. So
yeah, no, he does great. It's a good movie. I would watch it again. So I guess that makes of Kubrick's oeuvre, I like Paths of Glory and The Shining. I think that's it.
Those are really? Those are the only two?
I think so.
Wow. Okay.
Anyway, so that's all my movies. That takes us up to last night.
Okay. I don't have as many as you do, unsurprisingly. So let's see.
I have currently watched enough for one movie per day this year.
Yeah, I'm lagging a little bit on that. So after we recorded last time, I watched The Apartment as my final movie of the year. It's one of my favorites, and I think of it as a New Year's movie. It kind of takes place across the holidays, but the finale happens on New Year's, so I like to watch that movie on New Year's Eve.
I forgot we hadn't talked about New Year's Eve. I watched Cool Cat versus Dirty Dog, the brand new movie, on New Year's Eve, and I don't know how to talk about it, so it's just, yeah. Anyway, go on.
Probably the less said, the better. But I've talked about The Apartment on here before because I watched that movie fairly regularly. It's one of my favorites. The first movie that I ended up watching this year, although I wasn't thinking about it in those terms, ended up being Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem.
Fabulous beginning.
Which I was kind of bummed I missed that one in the theater because I'd heard good things. I have not. This was my first Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I think I probably saw at least one of the live action ones when I was really little, but I don't remember.
The Nielsens had the second one, and I believe we watched it.
Yeah, I believe you, but I don't remember anything about it. So this is basically my first exposure, and it's a lot of fun. I really enjoyed the way the four of them were all constantly talking over each other and busting balls and making fun of each other for shit. Having Jackie Chan there as their father figure was great. I think it is an issue with the screenplay, the fact that the movie introduces eight characters at the beginning of the third act that are all important. And I suspect if you are a TMNT person, you probably know who all of those characters are and you were very excited to see them all show up and be voiced by people you like. But I didn't know who any of them were. And I got very confused very quickly in the the end there. But
we watched all of the movies before we went to go see this one in theater, so I felt a little more caught up than it seems like.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I did really enjoy it. I would definitely watch another one. I definitely got a kick out of what ended up being the big final monster at the end. That's a really cool concept that was looked great. I really liked the animation style and all that. So yeah, good time. I haven't heard if they've announced if they're doing another one or if that's still
I thought they had, but I'm not sure.
They may have. I don't know. Okay, and then wow, it looks like everything that I watched this week actually was from last year. So this was all me playing catch up. I watched A Fire, which one word, AFIRE, the new Christian Petzold movie, which is on Mubi. Or no, it's on Criterion. I think Criterion actually distributed it, at least streaming.
I believe that is correct. I was just looking at it last night.
I've talked about him before because I watched several of his movies a couple years ago. I really like most of his stuff, and this one is really good. It was really solid. It was It's a bit more low-key than some of his other ones that I've seen. A lot of his stuff is he does, like, genre movies that just play out in weird ways. So, like, he has movies about, like, one of the ones I watched was about these two people who are, like, left-wing terrorists who have a teenage daughter, and the movie's told from, like, the daughter's perspective. And so it's all about how, like, they're fucking up her life by having to run from the government. This one is more, it's like a group of friends at this like vacation home. It's two friends at this vacation home. They go because one of them is working on a novel and he's looking for a place to write. And the other one is putting together a portfolio for something. And they go to this home that I think one of their mothers owns. And they find out that there's this other woman already staying there who they don't know. And it kind of throws everything into turmoil for them. But it's a really good movie. Wow, the dog is snoring so loud. That's probably coming through in the recording, but it's a really solid movie. It might end up on the back half of my top 10 from last year. Yeah, pretty easy to see if you have Criterion, and highly recommend. I watched Ferrari, which you talked about last time, I believe. It was okay. I don't know.
That car crash was brutal as fuck. I think I literally out loud in the theater went, "Oh fuck!"
Like, yeah, no, I think I did too, actually. And that's like I had heard about that. You know, it has like a brutal car crash,
and yet
I was not prepared for, especially since it comes like basically at the end of the movie, and there hadn't really been anything. Yeah, it was just insane.
It is the only thing I will remember from that.
Probably the most gruesome thing I've ever seen in a movie that wasn't a horror movie or a war movie, I think.
Absolutely.
Just horrifying. but that aside, I don't know. The performances are good, except for, what's her name, who I never like. Shailene Woodley. I don't like her. As an actor, I just don't think she's very good. I'm not usually a person who complains about bad accents, but she was trying to do an Italian accent in this movie, and
was she?
It comes through every once in a while. I've heard other people say the same thing, that they assumed her character was supposed to be American.
Yeah, I thought she was an American. No, but she was an expat. I thought she was an expat, and I thought the accent was supposed to be what she had picked up. But
I didn't catch anything about her being an expat. She had a very like sort of off and on Italian accent. But Adam Driver and Penelope Cruz are both really good. They have like a couple scenes together of like sort of conflict scenes between the two of them that are the best parts of the movie. But it's all very like the big sort of like central thrust of the drama in this movie is that the company Ferrari is going broke and he's trying to figure out how to keep it afloat and the strategy is to win this big race. And then people will want to buy the cars, like rich people will like custom order cars from them and stuff. And that's how companies like that were staying afloat at this time. And so there's one problem. I don't care if Ferrari goes bankrupt, and I don't feel like the movie did anything to make it, just assumed you would care. It didn't do anything to make it interesting. I guess this might be kind of, I don't think this is really a spoiler, but it's just a weird, there's all this talk about aside from winning the race, he's also like being encouraged to go to other bigger car companies and partner with like Ford, get outside money. And there's all this stuff about, cause his wife owns half the shares of the company. So he's having, and he's basically estranged from his wife. So he's trying to get her to agree to let him have control of her shares so that he's in a position to bargain with Ford or whatever. And there's all this stuff, all this back and forth about this. I saw the movie and I still don't know if he got a partnership with Ford. They never resolve that plot line. It's like the central dramatic thrust of the movie, and they never tell you what happened.
Well, based on the fact that Ford versus Ferrari took place 10 years right, exactly. Later,
I assume he ended up going to Fiat, which is the other possibility, but it never tells you in the movie, and it's just weird. Because so much of the movie, this is the thing that he's like, one of the things that is like occupying his mind throughout this movie, and it never tells you what happened. It's weird. But I don't know. I felt like you talked about how you felt like you would have been much more interested in a movie from his wife's perspective, as is often the case. And I think that's some, I just, I wanted to see a movie about this period 10 years ago where he has two kids that he's, and like his marriage is falling apart and like his kid is sick and he's this like guy who's always been able to make things the way he wants them and he can't figure out how to help his sick kid and all. Like you get glimpses of that through their discussion, but I feel like that would have been a much more compelling movie. I wanted to see that part. And like, I try not to like, it's not a legitimate criticism of movies to complain that they aren't about the thing you want them to be about. That's like, that's not a legitimate way to criticize movies, I don't think. So that I recognize that that is not like an actual problem with the movie. That's on me. But the thing that the movie was about, I did not find that interesting.
It definitely, I mean, that's a really valid point, and I hadn't really thought about that, but I agree. I can see, and I could see a driver killing in that, but I think that I think that what I saw in this is, again, you're looking at this is a movie that is like making this man out to be like maybe kind of a dick, but like a giant, right? Like he's like, and like you're supposed to like come in with some level of that reverence, I think, for like who he was. And I'm like, I don't care well, about your fast cars.
Like a central part of this, he has this illegitimate son with Shailene Woodley's character who is like almost, he's almost old enough to go through confirmation now. So he's like 11 or whatever that is. And he hasn't claimed him. He hasn't legally recognized him as his son. And there's this whole thing about whether or not he's going to do that, because if he legally recognizes him, then he becomes his heir. And it's this like weird, almost like medieval, like he's like royalty and he has to have an heir and he has this unrecognized heir. And there's all this like legal shit of like it's going to cause problems for the company going forward if you don't have a recognized heir or if you have an illegitimate heir that you haven't like. And it's all like it really does feel kind of weirdly medieval. And like out of place in a more or less modern movie. And I'm sure that like it's probably accurate, I guess, but it just seemed weird. And like it was just stakes that didn't really make sense to me. And I don't know. It is not a bad movie by any means. It's very well put together. It looks very good. there was one bit early on where that struck me as extremely funny. I don't know if this was intentional or not, but so there's a common thing in movies where you have, it's usually either a classroom or a church where you have a lesson being taught either by a teacher or a pastor. And it's the thing that like on the surface, it sounds like it's unrelated to what's going on in the plot, but like it's actually obviously central, right? In this movie, the pastor just preaches about cars. I thought it was very funny because he's in this town that like the only industry in this town is making these cars. So he just preaches sermons about engines. I don't know if that was meant to be funny, but I thought that was very funny. anyway, it was an okay movie. I was really hoping that it would land for me more, but yeah, again, not going to show up on my best of the year list.
Same.
Okay. Have you seen All of Us Strangers yet? You haven't, because you would have talked about it.
I would have talked about it. I think we will hopefully be going to go see it. I don't know, today, tomorrow, Tuesday, one of those days. So within the next few days, I will have seen it. It appears you didn't rate it.
Right, so I'm going to get into this. do you know the premise? Because it's one of those, like, I feel like I've heard some people talk about how you can't talk about the premise without it being a spoiler. I don't know that I necessarily agree with that, but...
There's gays.
There is, yes. That's one part of the story, yeah.
I don't really know more than that.
Okay. Well, I guess we might have to talk about it more after you see it then, because like I said, I don't really think of it as a spoiler. I think you get this from the trailer, but I've seen a lot of people talk about it in those terms, and I don't want to.
By the next time we record, I will for sure have seen it. So let's just talk about it then.
At any rate, I did a thing that I don't think I've ever done before, which was that I marked it as viewed, but I didn't rate it, because I feel like it definitely didn't land for me the way I was hoping that it would and kind of expecting it to based on things I'd heard about it. But I just feel so unsure about it in my own head of like what I thought about it and how well it actually fit together and stuff that I just couldn't land on anything rating wise. So I left that empty.
Intrigued.
Like I said, I don't think I've ever done that before. Although now that I have broken that seal, I might start doing that more often, but it is definitely an interesting movie. It's got really good performances. And yeah, I suspect people's reaction to it is going to depend a lot on what their relationship with their parents was like. So I'm very curious to hear your own thoughts once you've seen it.
We'll talk about it next time and have a spoiler discussion on it. So we
can... Yeah, maybe that's a good idea. Anyway, last night, as I told you, I had my whole night planned around watching the Kane Mutiny Court Martial, on which I thought was on Paramount Plus, but I sat down to watch it and found out that it is only on Paramount Plus with Showtime, which I don't have, and I was very annoyed about it. I ended up watching No One Will Save You on Hulu, which is another one that I'd been wanting to get to for a long time. It's like a sci-fi horror thing with what's her name, Caitlin Dever, who I really like. So it's kind of like a Signs-ish thing. It's like alien invasion, but it's all about this one character trying to like get through it on her giant farmhouse that she lives in alone. And it has kind of the part of there's basically no dialogue in it. I have mixed feelings about how that played out, because it's like I'm into that as an idea. It ended up feeling a little gimmicky though, because there were like a few sequences where it was like, it didn't make sense that no dialogue was happening, except that this is a right. Like if you were in that situation, you would say something, but it has this thing where no one talks in it, or hardly anyone. So at any rate, I was a little mixed on that, but there's some like really cool sci-fi stuff, some really cool alien designs. There's a lot of, you know, her likes having to like fight to survive with these sort of hostile aliens breaking into her house and shit. And the aliens are all different. Like they're clearly like the same species, but they're not like carbon copies of each other. They actually have, you know, they have like individual designs and stuff, which I feel like you don't see very often. And I appreciated that. That was cool. And it made the action sequences more interesting, because she's not just fighting the same thing over and over again. Like she has to come up with different ways to fight different ones because they're different. So yeah, it's definitely worth checking out. It's on Hulu. I think it was a Hulu original thing earlier this year. And I guess that was my last thing. That was last night, and then I did the Seventh Seal this morning. So that's all I've got.
All right, we did it. We did the things.
How long are we at here? That ended up being
about 100 minutes.
Okay, not too bad.
We're good. Cool. So I guess next time we will talk about Cry in the Dark, and then maybe the time after that we will talk about our best movies of the year. I don't know. I mean, like, you know, for the five people who listen, I don't know how much it matters, but like theoretically, if you wanted to like wait and talk about that in Oscar nominations and stuff and just have one big episode that was like that, we could do that. I mean, I guess by the time we next record, the Oscar noms will be out, but
yeah, I think so. I haven't actually heard a date for that, but I assume there is one.
The 23rd of January. Anyway, but the point is, next week we will talk about A Cry in the Dark, and we will see if you like it and how I feel about it on a rewatch.
Yeah, I'm very curious, because obviously Meryl Streep, and it's like one of her sort of famous performances, and I really like Sam Neill, who is also in it. So, I'm looking forward to it.
Cool. All right. We'll see everyone in a few weeks, or talk to everyone or whatever. Bye.
Bye, everyone.